Hello, friends. We are now continuing with our work on A Treatise on White Magic video commentary. It's number 5. And we're still in rule number 7, so it's 7.5. And this is 11 of June, 2018. Now, we have talked about a little bit about the Black Magician here. It's a tremendous definition of black magic, actually. You have a choice. We have a choice of two paths, and one path later on is known to him as the left-hand path, and the other the path of right activity. And on one path, he becomes proficient in black magic. And here's the way of defining it, which I think is very good. Which is only the developed powers of the personality subordinated to the selfish purposes of a man whose motives are those of self-interest and worldly ambition. This seems very straightforward. Of course, we're told that the concrete mind can be lifted to such a point that it is truly amazing in its capacity and is far beyond anything cultivated by those on the path of right activity. It's not the Syrian line of initiation. It's some kind of Davic line of initiation, and it's possible to ascend on this path very far on the what's called the path of Mahat, or pure mind. So it's an embracing of a former type of energy that was characterizing the previous solar system, the first major solar system, and a kind of refusal to go with the program of this particular solar system, which is the major love wisdom solar system, the second major and the fifth minor system. Now let's see, when it comes to the path of right activity, let's see what else it says. But further on black magic, these confine him to the three worlds, which really is the dense physical body of the planetary logos. So in a way, not a principle. He's confined to an unprincipled domain considered cosmically. These confine him to three worlds and shut the door, which opens onto life. Life being that which is encountered, as far as we're concerned, on the cosmic ethers, on the other path. And this is the good path, you know, this is the path of right activity. He subordinates his personality and exercises the magic of the white brotherhood, working always in the light of the soul or consciousness within the causal body, the soul or consciousness within the spiritual triad, the soul or consciousness within the monad. We have to not confine our understanding of the word soul only to the consciousness within the etheric body, consciousness within the egoic lotus, which is not quite on the cosmic etheric level, almost. Working always in the light of the soul, with the soul in all forms, with consciousness in all forms. That's how the master tries to work with us at this time, and laying no emphasis upon the ambitions of the personal self, which really, you know, is a kind of a mistaken identity anyway. We see ourselves as a very small thing, and we forget that we are a projection and an extension of the monad, which itself is an extension of the one life of the universe. So that sort of takes us here to the next consideration, clear discrimination of these two paths reveals what is called in some occult books, the narrow razor-edged path, which lies between the two. I mean, we do have to respect form and we have to respect spirit. Both, form and spirit must be respected. And so we cannot make haste with too great a rapidity. It seems like a contradiction, but the old saying, make haste slowly, really applies. And that way, which is the way of caution, we will not destroy the form by premature application of energies to it, which are just too strong for it to withstand. So this is the noble middle path of the Buddha, and marks the fine line of demarcation between the pairs of opposites and between the two streams, which he has learned to recognize, one going up into the gates of heaven, unto the gates of heaven, and the other passing down into the nethermost hell, which probably is not even found on one of the seven systemic planes, but perhaps even lower, as I hinted at, a kind of eighth sphere below even the physical level. I mean, it's possible to think in those terms, and maybe the wisest way is to proceed with respect for both form and spirit. Sometimes, you know, the mystic wants to reach God so quickly that that mystic will completely disrespect the form at his own peril, and then the form is suffering destruction or impairment and will have to be rebuilt. So there is a wise way. The Buddha is the Lord of wisdom, the Lord of light, and he is suggesting a wise path, which is not excessively rapid, nor so slow, because we get trapped in the dense physical body of the planetary logos, especially. Okay, so as I tried to explain, you know, sometimes you just have to choose between the higher way and the lower way, but there's a sort of a central point which rises towards the higher way and brings consideration of the form along with it. And when you look at the Ida, the Pingala, and the Sushumna, there's a central position. It's usually considered the path of soul or consciousness, not pure spirit, not pure form or matter. Matter is different from form, of course. Matter is the basic constituent, and form is built by the second aspect, building matter into some sort of a geometrical configuration. The second aspect is the great geometer. Okay, but sometimes Sushumna, the central channel, is actually considered to be spirit, and in that case, spirit somehow identifies with both form and soul, and yet is itself, and out of it came both form and soul. So that justifies the central position of spirit when it's being regarded in that manner. I think it's so important for many people to realize that hell is a temporary condition, as are all locales or karas or, you know, places within our planetary system. This whole idea of an eternity of heaven or hell is a sort of a fatuous idea concocted by the unenlightened human concrete mind and by the wish life, and it's extremely separative. And there are a number of religions, especially Christianity and the Islamic faith, that have to disabuse themselves of that particular conception. So, by the exercise of the two main weapons of the aspirant, discrimination and dispassion, the one applying to the mind, discrimination, the other applying to the astral body, dispassion, he gains that quality which is called, in this rule, the vital power. All right, well, this is, we have to watch our definitions here very carefully. because usually the plane of vitality is considered to be the etheric plane, but this is something else, perhaps. Just as the eye is the instrument of choice in choosing the way of travel on the physical plane, and has besides a potency all its own whereby it attracts and develops its own sign language, you know, one is led by the eyes of the leader, really. So a vital power is felt in the aspirant. So this is interesting, you know, let's just see if we can fathom this. A vital power is felt in the aspirant. This eventually brings the third eye into activity, and so there is gained a potency and a clear vision, which makes a choice and quick progress upon the way, a steady progression. All right, let's take a look here. The vital power feeds the third eye. So, this vital power gained upon the astral plane feeds the development of the third eye. He gains the quality, a certain type of energy which is called the vital power, and he involves the concept of the eye and how it is used. So a vital power is felt in the aspirant. And I want to say felt in the aspirant who chooses correctly and not the path of form. Okay, I think I can get something out of that. All right, let's call it the path of form. Right. Okay, so this eventually brings from the eye to the third eye. This is first we have to see in a normal way, from the normal eye to the development of the third eye. We have to see in the normal way, perspicaciously, and then the unitive eye, the blue eye, the eye of Shiva, can be developed. I feel the energy here of Taurus somehow. It's a very visual sign. It involves Venus, which is a visual planet, or planet promoting at least one aspect of vision along with Mercury. And so there is gained a potency and a clear vision, which makes right choice. And well, let's just say on the spiritual path, not just right choice on the physical plane, and quick progress upon the way, steady progression. This is not just an outward phenomenon, the singular. Okay. We are told that power is grown or developed in silence. I think one can feel that, you know. Sometimes we come together for the glamour meditation and we're silent, or partially, at least according to DK's suggestions, when smaller groups are working. We try it with a larger group to a degree, and one can feel the power grow in the silence. Power is grown or developed in silence. It's like saying, the synthesis which silence promotes develops power. All right, DVPS, DV, DVS. Let's try that. Okay, develops power. Okay. So synthesis relates to the first cosmic law, and in the synthesis there is no frictional waste, okay, and hence the development of power. and only he who can find a center of peace within his head. And this is really a big hint, you know. Sometimes DK is speaking in terms symbolic, but sometimes he's really talking about anatomical realities. And only he, excuse me, who can find a center of peace within his head, where the paths of the bodily forces and the spiritual inflowing tides, and I want to say from above, meet, can rightly practice true discrimination and true dispassion based on the third eye and pineal gland and the place where land and water meet, which is neither dry nor wet. We'll see more about that. So only there, in that area, etheric area around the pineal gland, can there be true discrimination and dispassion. And which bring the controlled astral and mental bodies under the guidance of the soul. PNG, and hopefully, yes, that's it. So look at this again, and only he who can find a center of peace within his head, where the paths of the bodily forces, you know, coming up the Kundalini and the latent fires, rise into the etheric brain, and the spiritual inflowing tides conducted by the ethers, can meet only where these two meet, in that etheric area around the pineal gland, can rightly practice true discrimination and that dispassion, which bring the controlled astral and mental bodies under the guidance of the soul, because otherwise the elementals go in their own direction, satisfying their own proclivities. Then he can understand the significance of the vibrating poles and achieve that point of equilibrium, which is the result of their interaction and vibration. The high and the low, which is bodily, as he says. And the high has to do with spiritual inflowing tides. We are the meeting place of many forces, and where those forces meet, there may at first be turbulence and a contesting between forces, and eventually a harmonization and the ability to use the higher properties and virtues of each area. Both are necessary. Arjuna, on the field of Kurukshetra, you know, the greater group within his family must win, but that does not mean that the forces of form will be completely abrogated. They have to be used if there's going to be the kind of redemption which the monad has undertaken. The vibrating poles, the high and low, and in a way, from the chakric point of view, the vibrating poles are the highest head center and the base of spine center. They are astrologically Uranus and Pluto. Uranus the purpose and Pluto the will. And somehow the descent and the meeting, the descent and ascent and the meeting in a place which is really in neither center, but in a center within the head. Some people call it the cave center. gives the magician his third eye and the ability to practice true discrimination and dispassion and direct the forces of the mind and astral body properly. Really, the elemental forces have a will of their own, or at least a tendency of their own, and it's vitally important that we learn how to master them. A master, of course, has complete mastery over all this, even if his instrument has become a Maya Virupa, a will-created body, a body generated through Kriya Shakti, which finally, I think, is a monadic power ultimately. So the sensing of the dual forces and the clear discrimination of the two paths leads to the development of the vital power. This is the a very straight statement, and one that has to be enlarged in order to make its impact upon us. The sensing of the dual forces from above, the inflowing spiritual tides, and the bodily forces from below, and the two paths, one leading to the right and to the left, leads to the development of the vital power, which is an extension of sight. Note that we are forming here a cross. We have the, what is it here? The higher tides, spiritual tides above, bodily powers below, left-hand path, and the right-hand path. It can be called other things, but, you know, let me just do that. Right-hand path to the right, of course, and this will create the cross, right-hand path. Okay, this vital power demonstrates its first activity in enabling the aspirant to achieve a point of balance and so stand at that pinnacle of achievement whereon a choice is made. Libra is always involved with choices, and the pinnacle of achievement suggests the cross becoming the pyramid, the fire within the pyramid, as that central point where the forearms meet, creates the possibility of an ascent to a place of perspective. Sent to a place of perspective. Always with initiation, we are trying to gain a higher perspective on energies and forces with which we have been involved previously and which have perhaps trapped us. But as we rise out of them through pratyahara, through abstraction, withdrawal, whatever you want to call it, we can see better, manipulate better, we can become the director and the master of the forces which previously imprisoned us. So let's see, if we can sense all this, and the first activity of the vital power, as it apparently has other activities, achieving a point of balance and so standing at on that pinnacle of achievement where choice is made, this sounds like an initiation. Type of initiation. And we can see, because the third eye is activated, and we have a balanced point of view, a completed point of view, which is possible because the eye of synthesis is operating. So, you know, at the top of the pyramid, we can have or develop that synthetic vision. All of these things are occult developments which are most necessary. They lie ahead. They have to be achieved. We study academically now. We will become increasingly practical occultists and turn our accurate, hopefully, theory, our accurate theory, into demonstrable fact. This is what we have to do. Now, I can see that I've done right-hand path, and yeah, that's good. No, it's not good. R-I-G-H-T and path. Okay, replace. Yes, yes, and yes. You have to admit, you know, it's a very practical book. Of course, much of it is not understandable by us entirely at this point. We'll see that that is the case. Hints are given, but words are missing, words of power are missing, methods of controlling certain forces are missing, and wisely so, because, you know, just like the old joke that so many healers just can't wait to get their hands on you, you know. So many magicians just can't wait to start spouting off the magical words without knowing what they really lead to. It's just that inflation, that sense of power that they enjoy, and they would even summon negative forces just for the pleasure of showing they could do so, as Aleister Crowley actually did. You know, what's the use of invoking a demon, some negative entity, just to show you can do it? It's or if there's more to it, you want to send that demon on some kind of mission, then it's even worse. So what is the choice when we stand? What is the choice when we stand on that pinnacle of achievement? What's it all about? For the aspirant, it is between rapid and slow progress. Well, let's just say, if the aspirant can steady himself or herself, then there will be more rapid progress. Instead of, you know, kind of coming and going and doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that and going forward spasmodically and subsiding back into one's normal form-directed life, what is this choice? So let's just see, you know, at a certain pinnacle of observation, choice becomes possible. What is that choice? Let's see if I can even... Okay, what is that choice? When we stand at a pinnacle of observation and possible intervention. Okay, so maybe some of us, being aspirants, have made that choice and have committed ourselves to more rapid, steady progress, whereby we become a steadily approaching point of light instead of a waxing and waning light, you know, two steps forward, one step back, or maybe equal, you know, the shuffle, wearing out the soles of the feet, as Master Moria suggests. So instead of waxing and waning as what should be a steadily approaching light, we become that intensifying, steadily intensifying light. Okay, for then there will be more rapid progress. For the disciple, accepted and loyal, and this is what the true disciple is. The accepted disciple. It is the choice between methods of service. So that, you know, let's really identify these things, because we're all faced with these determining choices, which are so important relative to our success upon the spiritual path. That between rapid and slow progress. Okay, so let's get that. You know, I learned how to do this from a fellow that I figured really good creative compilations. His name is Zach, and he's made wonderful compilations, and some of the words are bolded and enlarged for emphasis, and others are not. I think it's very useful. For the initiate, it often lies betwixt spiritual advancement and the arduous work of staying with the group and working out the plan. Now, okay, so this is another type of choice, and the bodhisattvic impulse is there for some, and they shoulder a staff, but the rules of the road tells us that staff has a crook to hold the wandering sheep. And the others, I think, are more the Pratyeka Buddhas and have more the hard line, maybe the line of the first ray, and they just forge ahead. And they're not so determined to gather the straying sheep. And when you have both of those rays, you have a real conflict, but also the chance of much spiritual success and much ability to set an example for others, both of strength and concern. Now, the master also has his pinnacle. Remember that everyone, depending on the cross, has their own pinnacle. It will be different depending on the cross on which one is found. The aspirant is found pretty much on the later part of the immutable cross, transferring in Pisces sometimes to the fixed cross. The disciple is found on the fixed cross. The initiate is found beginning to understand the cardinal cross, but he has to go through a stage of the fourth degree where he's on no cross at all. And then the master, fifth degree initiate, beyond is on the cardinal cross. So the pinnacle will be different depending on the cross. So it is the choice between. Always choice, isn't it? Choice. It's a Saturnian thing. Saturn is most powerful in the sign Libra, where it's not only the hierarchical ruler, but the planet which is exalted. The choice between the seven paths, now nine paths, and it will therefore be apparent how much more strenuous and difficult is his problem as he tries to divine the path along which he descended. Somewhere there is the idea that you must take the path towards freedom along the path upon which you descended. Now, the Buddha apparently didn't do that at first. He chose to remain with the earth on the path of earth service, and as DK said, it really wasn't his path at all, but there was such great compassion. Now, you know, from one perspective, he had the third ray monad, but I've been theorizing about a monadic demonstration on the monadic plane within the monadic vehicle, Temple of Ezekiel, and a kind of monadic demonstration within the three circles found upon the logoic plane, which might be some ultimate kind of monadic ray, and not so much a sub-ray that we might be finding on the monadic plane. All of this has yet to be determined, but the fact that there are seven great circles on the monadic plane and three on the logoic plane seems to require that we look at the monad's demonstration in terms of a quite full seven possibilities and then three possibilities. If I were to look at this, you know, and you would see it. Actually, I think I should use Tuya's if I can. Well, it's here. It's here. I really want to get it into focus if I can. Because she has made some very beautiful, diagrams here. Evolution of a Solo Logos. Yeah, and here we have it. Well, in this particular diagram, they are, triangles. But, they are called circles, at least the monadic presentation is called circles in Letters on Occult Meditation. I think it's page 39 or so, seven great circles on the monadic plane. And presumably, if you can call triangles circles on the monadic plane, you can do that on the logoic plane as well. So let's take a quick look. And this is Letters on Occult Meditation. And we're going to just go to page 39 and hope for the best. There it is, monadic plane, seven great groups. Okay, well, they're not called circles, but to me, they are circles. it really makes no difference. And if I were to try to look at this, in terms of our hierarchy, here they are circles. Here are the three external Buddhas of activity, and there are three hidden Kumaras, and everything's a circle here. And I've often wondered, a little digression here, but there are three beings interlocked, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and they are in a way responsive to the Solo Logos. And I wonder if there are not some kind of analogous grouping to the Kumaras around Sanat Kumara. I wonder if there are not Kumaras, six of them, around our Solo Logos. That's just, speculation. Speculation is what it is, really. And when will it be proven, if ever? I'll just try to remain alert to the possibility of proof. What will proof be? Will it be logic? Will it be a correspondence? Will it be an intuition? If it's really going to be proof, it has to be direct sight. It has to be intuition. Or maybe the convincingness of pure reason, which is intuitive anyway. The true intuition doesn't lie, and it's not personal. So how do we know when we're face to face with a true intuition? I think it has a very deep, salient impact upon us. Yeah. And it's of a different order, far less superficial than that which reasoning and logic can deliver. But, let us get more deeply into the intuition as we become fourth degree initiates and beyond, and let us see what it really feels like. There's a sentiency involved in that kind of touch, and the sentiency will make plain the difference between itself and that which logic and reason have delivered earlier in the process. All right, so anyway, the master has a big choice. Big choice between the seven, now nine paths. The nine paths are not, those extra two paths are not delineated, but it's interesting that the seven major Pleiades have parents, parent stars. They're called parents, the mother and father of the Pleiades, of the seven sisters, and they're called Atlas and Pleione. And it all works out to a nine, and it's a very, as one of my friends says, it's a feminine constellation. And we have to expect that somehow each of the seven paths leading to the Pleiades, as they ultimately do, would be focused on one or other of the seven stars. And if we have nine paths, that Atlas and Pleione would somehow be included. But then again, these are matters that lie before the high initiates, and for them, they are practical issues involving their destination. And for us, they are cosmological speculations. All, however, prepares the aspirant for right choice through right discrimination, leading to right action and made possible through practiced dispassion. It's not a question of just where you feel like going, your impulse to go here or there. Rather, it is intuitively arrived at with keen deliberation, and the emotions don't get in the way. Now, in this case, the emotion for the Buddha was this incredible compassion for humanity and the desire to stay with humanity. His second ray was really coming out. So up on the Logoic plane, does he ultimately have a second ray? As the monad called the volatile essence is released from its one of the monadic vehicles, does it, in his case, find a place in that second circle or second triangle? And is it really the second ray ultimately and after all? I know I'm going a little far here in the speculation about two monadic rays, but here's the point. The essence of the monad is not any ray, it's pure being. And it's sort of the vehicle in which the monad or the volatile, the flying essence is contained that determines the ray. So it's not the very essence of the monad that determines the ray. The essence of every monad is absolutely identical, but other types of discrimination have to do with the vehicles and the matter and the through which these units of pure being manifest. So maybe it's possible that the great second ray finally will receive the Buddha, even though his monad is said to be on the third ray, in a way that cannot be refuted in cosmic fire. And the Christ, of course, there's no question him being on the ray path. It's going to be the second ray at the moment, and his logoic demonstration will be through that second circle or triangle. So all, however, prepares the aspirant for right choice. And notice, my goodness, is the master also an aspirant? In a way, necessarily so. For right choice through right discrimination, leading to right action, the mind is involved, the ability to tell the difference, leading to right action and made possible through a practice dispassion, which does not, and this means this, sorry. This practiced dispassion means the vision will not be clouded by extraneous impulse. In this sentence is summed up the technique of the warrior on the battlefield of the desire plane. Whoa, it sounds so good that I want to make it even bigger. Forgive me. All, however, prepares the aspirant for right choice. Because there is only really one right choice in this return on the way of high revolution. That's the amazing thing. It's a completely free choice, and yet there's only one right choice. So you are free to make the right choice. Right choice through right discrimination between where these paths lead and what they do and what's required, leading to right action to prepare for the path and also perhaps serve the arena that you are leaving behind as you prepare for that path. Remember, the 6-degree initiates have been retained by Sanat Kumara because there's such a crisis here, but they put in their choice of which path they will take and then help him. Right action can be directed towards the field you leave behind, and right action in terms of the preparation for the path you must tread. and made possible through practice, dispassion. You don't get swept away by any kind of individual preference. It's something more than that, far more. In this sentence is summed up the technique of the warrior upon the battlefield of the desire plane. It's a very scorpionic statement, isn't it? And this is a treatise on the control of the astral body, a scorpionic statement in this treatise on the control of the astral body, which Lord knows we need to control, it being normally that vehicle which prevents the kind of alignment that we're trying to achieve, especially on this planet, which has a planetary logos, who is not yet cosmically controlling his own astral body. It should be noticed that in the steadily developing power of choice and the loyally fought battle of the astral plane, the consciousness of the man shifts stage by stage. Everything here is so very important. So, you know, loyally fought battle. We pick up our weapons and we don't relinquish them until the battle is over, either ending in our defeat or our victory. And we have this steadily developing power of choice. If we choose correctly, it's an act of will. Christ chose correctly in the Garden of Gethsemane. He could have relinquished his adherence to that higher strand of will, that higher impulse of will, and everything would have been very different in a negative way for the humanity that followed after. But he chose aright. It should be noticed that in the steadily developing power of choice. So just look at your own life, you know. Your choices become more and more important. At first you have this crisis of opportunity. Earlier in life, and you're faced with many possibilities, some of which actually will lead to real spiritual development. And later, you have a crisis of expression. Maybe it's more around the second Saturn return. Maybe the first one, crisis of opportunity, is more around the first Saturn return. I mean, you know, not literally, but in that area. And how shall we then express what we have learned and meditated upon and now understand? How should we do that? And our ways and our means, and are we truly efficient? The third ray is involved here with its tendency towards efficiency, and it is the ray very much governed by Saturn, the planet of choice. So first it is the, oh boy, it's not humorous, but it is humorous, you know. First, it is the battered, earth-weary aspirant who has to struggle with desire, with glamour, with ambition, and with his sensitive emotional body. He thinks the battle is stupendous, but from the wider range, it's relatively small, yet all that he can stand. I love this. You know, it's written by someone who's really been through it. And we are passing through it, okay, and we're learning the hard way. I wonder if there's any other way, really. He tells us that if we don't make it part of our experience, we haven't really learned. We can't just accept what somebody else says. It has to be worked out in our own life. So the man is shifting stage to stage, and here the stages are given. The battered, earth-weary, you know, the world is too much with us, aspirant, who has to struggle with desire leading towards form, with glamour distorting and hiding truth, with ambition in which he identifies with this little personal self and wants to exalt it, when he's really something much different and much bigger and more essential, and with his sensitive emotional body affected by every impact, and attracted or driven away, and constantly responsive to these impacts. He thinks the battle is stupendous, but from the wider angle, it is relatively small, yet all that he can stand, and that we can ask ourselves even right now, how much can we stand? We ask ourselves that. And do we think we are engaged in a stupendous battle? Are we struggling? Are we in the Scorpio phase up to the, and through the third initiation, the tests are being applied by Scorpio, even though it's most identified with the second initiation, but, you know, physical tests, emotional tests, mental tests, these apply to Scorpio at the different initiations. Later, now here, now notice here. Here, he distinguishes between the aspirant and the probationary PRB, probable, no, well, probationary disciple. Later it is the experienced probationary disciple who wrestles in the veil of illusion. Wrong thought, perhaps. Wrong interpretation of impression. And deals not alone with his own nature, but with the forces of the veil also, recognizing its dual nature. So the range of activity is expanded. Then the disciple, who is more than the probationary disciple, comes forth to battle and faces with courage and often with clear vision, hopefully increasingly with clear vision, the forces arrayed against him, and we might say, and they really are arrayed against him. And they involve not only those in his own nature, forces in his own nature, and in those aspects of the astral plane to which he naturally acts, but also involve the forces of illusion arrayed against the group of disciples to which he belongs. I'm remembering when Master DK had kind of the necessity of excusing himself and saying, look, I've been involved lately. There's been an attack against my ashram. I think it was with some kind of thought form that was giving good words of mediocre cheer. I think that's how he described it, and it ended up quite severely damaging a couple of disciples. It might have been that, but who knows? Anyway, there was an attack on his ashram, and he had to deal with it. And we as disciples, hopefully that's what we are increasingly are, have to deal with the forces that are thrown at our group, because we are increasingly group conscious. At least we should be. We're moving beyond individualism and even beyond an excessive concern with individuality. We begin to be able to say, I am the group, you know, and mean it, understand it. So let all disciples take note of this and have it in mind in these difficult and strenuous days. And this is written back in the 30s, right? Or even maybe he began the book in the late 20s. How far did he get when he wrote this? I don't know. All of that, these were given out as lesson sets, you know. And so only later published as complete books, but that was the plan, that they would be completed books after all the lessons were given. And DK wrote with that in mind. So we've got, you know, what do we have here? You know, three levels so far. We have the battered aspirant, the more experienced probationary disciple and the true disciple, who may not yet be an accepted disciple. Well, anyway, such disciples are in conscious contact at times with their soul forces, and for them there is no defeat nor turning back. You know, it is the aspirant and the probationer who from time to time turn back. It's disappointing eventually for them. They may not know what they're doing at the time, and it's disappointing for the people around them that would like to see them go ahead, the disciples around them. But we outgrow the tendency to turn back. These disciples, and it's obvious that DK is hoping we number among them, they are the tried warriors, scarred and tired. Maybe not scared and tired, but scarred and tired, yet knowing that triumphant victory, Scorpio, right, lies ahead for the soul, the ultimate soul, the consciousness of the One, however attenuated it may be, for the soul is omnipotent. Well, we have to admit, right, these are encouraging words. Now, accepted disciples, that's the, let's go back here. How far can we go? Well, okay, I'm going to have to repeat this. What I'll do is simply accept the disciples, and we'll say preceded by aspirants, probationers, and disciples who battle all the above enumerated factors plus the black forces arrayed against the elder brothers. Of course, Master Moria kind of puts it in proportion when he says, you know, you trouble yourself with a few minor demons while the daggers of Satan are aimed at our backs. I guess that's the shambolic perspective, and we can't handle that. So, but we can handle what we can handle, and not more. Maybe a little more, but not much more. We have to stay within the range of our possibilities. So accepted disciples, that's the fourth group, and he's showing us the stages here, stage by stage. Accepted disciples are handling all the above, the warfare within, and that which is having to do with the environment and with the group, plus the Black Lodge or those equivalent to the disciple who may be attacking him and are on the black path. They can call upon the spiritual energies of their group, and at rare and indicated moments upon the master under whom they work, and later in the description of the use of the violet light for defense, this technique will be given in this book. Thus the work and labor expands, thus the responsibility and struggle steadily increases. We're just microscopic man and we think it's a big deal, but it's what we can handle, you know. We're just tiny little atoms compared with some beings. Yet at the same time, there's also a steadily growing reception of potencies which can be contacted and utilized, and which, when correctly contacted, ensure victory. So not only the struggle, but the energy currents from above, which can be used to guarantee victory. Okay, friends, so this is going to be the end of A Treatise on White Magic video commentary, number 5, and its rules for the astral plane, and it's rule 7, and we're calling it 7.5. And now our next task will be to begin something, and let's just call it beginning. It'll be number 6, and it'll be rule 7. It'll be 7.6. So thank you for being here and thinking along with me as we continue our kind of study group experiment here, looking as deeply as we can, given the time limitations and the limitations of knowledge and penetration, to help us assimilate what the Tibetan has written as thoroughly as we can before the new dispensation, the third dispensation, is offered from the year 2025 onward. So many blessings, lots of love. We'll see you before long when I can. Maybe tonight still, I don't know. Let's see what's possible. Bye-bye.